This morning we're studying Esther, the book of Esther. So if you know where Job is right before Psalms, and right before Job is Esther. All right, what do we know about Esther? Let's pool our collective something.
Pretty short.
It's fairly short.
It
doesn't mention God. Doesn't mention him as God or as Yahweh at all. Yes, very interesting. Yeah. Okay. Very interesting. Is God present in the book?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you see his providential hand all throughout. It's pretty obvious. Yes. What else do we know about Esther?
That's her Babylonian name for Jewish name, Hadassah, which is lovely.
Okay. Okay.
Is this an answer to your own questions?
Well, I don't know. You're not answering any.
No, because he's jumping in front of me.
Okay, well, give me something. What's Esther mean?
Everything I was going to say.
What does Esther mean? Do you know? Does anybody know?
No, that's a good question.
It means star. It means star. Yeah.
A star.
Yeah.
There you go.
Star.
A star.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty adventurous story.
So, I think that's one of the things of the books in the Old Testament. It's probably the most story. It's written as a really good story. So all the others are obviously history, and you know they have good content. But even how the book is laid out and how the plot unfolds is just a great story. Like my kids love when we read through the Book of Esther. Speaking of my kids. Could you go call him in, please? Or Nick, could you call him in? Thank you. All right, so Esther, let's kind of go over this. So as a story, just so you know, as a story, we're going to read a fair amount. So we won't read the whole thing, but I really do want us to just kind of get caught up in the story a little bit because I think that is really how it's designed to be experienced. So these events, King Ahasuerus, or if you have the NIV, I think it's Xerxes.
Xerxes,
yeah, which is what we know from history. The Hebrew really is more Ahasuerus, so whatever, they're the same guy. So this takes place in Persia, 486 to 464 BC. Remember, when you're going BC, the big number's first, right, because it's farther away. So it was roughly a 20-year reign of this guy. This is because we're going through the Book of Malachi. It's pretty close to Malachi in terms of date. So the stuff that's going on in Judea that Malachi is dealing with, understand around that time is when the events in Persia are taking place as well. Some interesting historical facts here on your sheet. This is the last historical book in the Old Testament. So there are some prophetic books that may be a little closer to Jesus' time, but in terms of the history books, so Genesis all the way through Kings, Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther is the last historical book. So if you're going just chronologically, you get to Job. Job is technically considered what kind of literature? Do you guys know? It's wisdom. It's wisdom literature. A lot of it is poetic. So although it is history, it's usually put together in the wisdom literature section. So the wisdom literature is Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. So even though Job is one of the oldest books of the Bible, it's lumped together in the wisdom section. Who mentioned it? I forget. Nick, I think Nick mentioned the word God or Yahweh is never mentioned in the book at all. The New Testament also never quotes this book or alludes to the book, which is really interesting. This is true with a couple other books as well. This is one of two books named for a woman. What's the other one? Ruth. Yeah, who also had another name?
And the book of Judith.
There's no book of Judith. There are two heroines in the book of Esther. Who are they? Yeah. Esther. And? Well, he's a hero, not a heroine. Who's the other heroine? She's often overlooked.
Vashti.
Vashti. Yeah. Vashti. And we'll read about her in just a little bit. And again, I just want to emphasize, it's just a great story. Just like Jonah is a great story, there's irony and there's plot and character development, that sort of thing. The same is true with Esther as well. In fact, I was reading something that was talking about even Esther, if you kind of watch her through the book, she even grows as a person. Like there's spiritual growth that you see in Esther's own life as she's becomes queen. This is a fun fact. Jews in synagogues usually read Esther around the time of Purim. That's where they get the holiday Purim. And whenever Haman's name is mentioned, they all hiss or boo. So I say Haman and you go, or whatever. Like he's the bad guy of the story. So it's very interactive, actually, in synagogue. And this has been true throughout the millennia. Okay, some themes. Even though God is not mentioned, it's clear that the providence of God is forefront in this whole thing. So we see the providence of God. We also see that God uses irony, even in historical events, to bring things about. So we'll see where Haman builds a 50-cubit-high gallows to kill Mordecai. And then Haman is killed on the 50-cubit gallows that he builds, right? So there's plot twists and role reversals, that sort of thing. Keep your hand here in Esther 1, but go over to Proverbs 21. And I mention this because we see this theme played out within the book. So Proverbs 21:1, and this is a great one to underline or highlight, whatever you do. The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of Yahweh. He turns it wherever he will. So it doesn't matter if, you know, if it's you, your kids, your congressman, the president, a king, whatever. God is the one who can easily change their heart. Just like you take a garden hose and you're like, well, I'm going to water this plant and this plant and this plant and this plant. Like, that's how God can change king's hearts. Like, I'm just going to change it. And he just does. And that's what we see in the book of Esther. We see Ahasuerus or Xerxes, however you want to say it. We see him just make the weirdest decisions. And it's like, why? I mean, the guy's really a drunken lunatic. If you think about it, and I'll pull that theme out too, but he is really a drunken lunatic, and yet, like, it's almost always favor that he shows to Esther and the Jews. Why? Because God controls his heart, and he gives Esther favor. Okay. The last theme here, as we turn back to Esther, is, and I think this is something we just have to grapple with, that God often uses people of questionable moral character to do great things. We would like all of our heroes to be just pure as snow, and it just ain't the thing. It just doesn't happen. Even Esther. Esther is of questionable moral character in some ways, and yet God uses her in great ways. One other thing I wanted to show the map. This is the Persian Empire in the timeline that we're talking about. This was massive. I mean, it's really hard to imagine just how powerful the Persian Empire was at this time. And it was Greece that came in and really started destroying their empire. But this was just massive. The little, the resolution is low, but in the middle there, there's the yellow word that says Persian Empire. And then below it is an unrecognizable word. That's where Susa is, okay, just so you know. So Susa is the citadel. The citadel is the capital of the Persian Empire. And so that's where these events take place. It's basically modern-day Iran is where it is. And so all these events take place in Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, those kind of areas were sort of the center of power for the Persian Empire. Any questions or comments before we start kind of just working through the book? Good? Nick, just imagine also, like, no telephones, no text message, no email. Like, if you wanted to get a message from one end to the other, it was just a chain of, like, horses that would they would take it across the end. It could take months to go across, and yet they controlled this whole area. Pretty impressive. Okay. If you look at the outline here, you'll notice that it really does revolve, the outline really does revolve around people. So we see drunken Ahasuerus, modest Vashti, beautiful Esther, loyal Mordecai, murderous Haman, and then Esther's fear, Haman's arrogance, the great reversal, which is really between the king Esther and Haman, it's all three of them together, and then the Jews are saved by Esther and Mordecai's decree. But this is really a story about people and how God used these specific people. So let's kind of dive in. Again, I'm gonna read a fair amount, but I think this is good. This story is meant to be read. So Esther chapter 1 verse 1. Now in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all of his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and the governors of the provinces were before him. While he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. Who does he sound like? What other king does he sound like? Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah, look at the glory of what I have made. Look at what I have built. Yeah. Verse 5, and when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, and mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And the drinking was according to this edict, there's no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desires. This is a big debauched party. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. So he wants to celebrate his greatness, and he does this by just throwing this massive party. It's like half a year long, and then at the end is sort of like the grand finale, the week-long celebration where, I mean, it's just a massive kegger is what it really is, and people can drink as much or as little as they want. It's free. It's for you guys, whatever. I mean, he's so rich. Like, they're drinking free wine out of golden vessels. Have all you want. It's just this lavish, gluttonous party, just about how great he is. So we've got drunken Ahasuerus, and we'll see throughout the book, I think one or two other times, where it's almost like he's always got a drink in his hand. I mean, he's just not a great guy. So, and then we've got Vashti. In the seventh day, verse 10, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mahuman, Biztha, Harbana, Bigtha, Abagatha, Zethar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Vashti refused to come to the king's command, or at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Now, we're not told for sure here, but it seems like it wasn't just like, hey, come out and be here. It seems like there may have been some sort of weird sexual immorality part of it as well, which is why she would refuse. Verse 13, then the king said to the wise men who knew the time. So this is a problem. The queen is rejecting the king's command. That's a problem. So the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure, toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshena, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meris, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. There's going to be a feminist uprising. That's what's going to happen. All the women are going to rebel. I mean, if Vashti can do it to the king, then what power do you have over me, husband? I mean, that's the argument that's being made here. Verse 18, this very day, the noble women of Persia Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath and plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household and speak according to the language of the people. So this is the end of Vashti. She takes a stand against her husband. And again, we're not told explicitly, but it seems like there's some sort of nefarious thing happening for him to call her out. But this would set a precedent throughout the whole kingdom. Can't have that. Can't have women disobeying their husbands and disobeying their leaders. And so they go, well, we need to get rid of Vashti. Interestingly, it's not mentioned that she's put to death. It's just right. Mentioned that she's put away.
Yeah,
which is also interesting. So we'll see here in a little bit that the king has a harem. He has a bunch of concubines, right? This is very common. And so it seems like she was just demoted from queen to concubine. And so it's likely that she knew Esther. If she wasn't killed, she probably knew Esther and knew some of the other ladies who were concubines and may have even helped inform Esther in her role, as we'll see in a little later on. Okay. So we've got drunken Ahasuerus, we've got modest Vashti, and now we have beautiful Esther. I won't read the whole chapter. I'll start with the first four verses, and then we'll skip down to verse 12. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa the citadel under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them, and let the young woman, who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. So he's going to find a new wife. And so they go through this sort of testing phase or whatever. And this is where we meet, in verses 5 through 11, this is where we meet Mordecai. This is where we meet Esther and their role. They live there in Susa. Mordecai actually works in the service of the king. And so even though he's sent far and wide, actually Esther is a local girl. Verse 12. Now when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil and myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women. It's kind of crazy, like 12 months to get yourself ready for the king. When the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem in the custody of Shazgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go in to the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. This is probably the most controversial aspect of the book, right here. Because, what this ends up being is basically a sex audition. That's what this is. So the language in chapter 2 is pretty clear. He's got a group of virgins in one harem, and then they go into the king, which is the common Old Testament euphemism for intercourse, and then they go to the second harem. It's a second spot where they are now called concubines. So that's what this is. And Esther, we'll see in a little bit, gives no pushback to this, right? I mean, if this were happening in our own family, we'd be like, no, we're out of here. We're not doing this. Like, death first. And she just goes along with the flow. And that's where it seems like she's not exactly the most godly woman here. She just goes along with this thing. Now, it could just be that it's the culture where it's like, well, if you want to be queen, like, this is what you got to do, you know, and this is what we're going to do, and I got a shot at being queen. And what's interesting, and this is the controversial part, is it seems as though God gives her favor in the midst of this quest. Like, Ahasuerus likes Esther the best. How did he like it? Through this trial period.
I think it's memorable, too, that Mordecai doesn't push back.
Right?
He's her guardian, and I think he almost sees that as a blessing for her.
An opportunity.
Even though, you know, her virginity is taken away by some drunken idiot, like, she's also in physical blessing, because whether or not the concubines ever went back to the king, I'm sure they lived in lavishness.
Sure.
Yeah. It was a place of honor, regardless, but, yeah, great cost.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's hard, you know, I mean, ancient culture was crazy, you know, compared to what we're used to. If we were to bring the ancients to our culture, they'd be like, you guys are crazy. Like, what is going on here, right? I mean, we got guys dressing like women. Like, what is happening, right? So you just kind of get comfortable with your own culture's craziness. And
unless you brought some Romans, they'd be like, wow, you guys are tame.
Right? Let's get this party started. Yeah. Right. All right, so verse 15. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her in as his own daughter to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all of the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. So again, we see this. It's like she won favor. Like there was something about Esther that won the favor in this king's eyes. Again, God is not mentioned, but we often call this the divine passive, where God is doing something in the background and you know that it's God who's at work. Okay. Questions on this section? Comments?
Do we know, I'm kind of curious about this, when you're reading this recently, do we know, like, what the concubines did, or besides performing their duties? Like, because they rarely ever went to the king, did they just sit around and do beauty stuff? Or, like, did they have duties? Did they?
I don't know.
Did they cook, or
Yeah, they would have kids. Yeah, I mean, that was part of the, yeah. Yeah, so they would probably raise their own family. Beyond that, I don't know, to be really honest with you.
To me, it struck me that Esther won everyone's favor, even before she went to the king, like when she was still in the beautifying process. It seems like she must have been a pretty bright young woman. And, like, she knew her stuff probably, you know, if she was kind of a blonde dunce or something, I don't think she would have stuck out.
So it's kind of interesting. She really is a Joseph figure. I mean, even we skipped the part, but like even in the first harem, like everybody loves her. Like for some reason, like everybody's drawn to her. You know, the chief eunuch is, you know, thinks she's great. You know, I mean, it's just something about her. Like God has gifted her with favor, and so yeah. But beyond that, I'm not sure we know. There's probably Old Testament biblical histories that would talk a little bit more about harems and that sort of thing. Yeah. Okay.
Why does he give remission of taxes because he got a wife?
He's celebrating, man. Yeah. Listen, when the government gives you remission of taxes, you just take it, okay? You might not understand that right now, but you will later.
He wanted to create a national debt.
Yeah. Debase the value of the currency. Whole deal. Yeah. All right. Now we have the point of intrigue. Ooh. Verse 19. Now when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people. So she didn't tell him she was a Jew, as Mordecai commanded her. For Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So there's just this little four-verse intrigue thing, and then that's tucked away for a while. And that'll come back and be the plot twist a little later on. And then we're introduced to Haman. Chapter 3, verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And the king's servants were at the king's gate, bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, he would not listen. They told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's word should stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. And so as they made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. So this is crazy. This guy wants to kill every single Jew because Mordecai refuses to bow down. I mean, you just think logic. Like sin does really illogical things to you. Like, why not just kill Mordecai? Like, just bump him off, right? Instead, he wants to kill all of his kindred, all of the Jews. I mean, that's the murderous craziness going on in this little situation. Okay. So you know this kind of the rest. Haman goes to the king, and he wants to put all the Jews to death. The king's like, "Yeah, sure, I'll sign that," and he signs it. Uh-oh. Not good. Okay, so we've got drunken Ahasuerus, modest Vashti, beautiful Esther, loyal Mordecai, murderous Haman. And now we have fearful Esther, chapter 4, verse 1. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city. And he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. Can't be sad in front of the king. You remember that when Nehemiah wanted to go back to Jerusalem? The king noticed something about him. You remember? Why are you sad? I've never seen you sad. You don't want to be sad in front of the king. like, this guy could just put you to death. Like, stop bumming me out. Like, you're done. I want a happy guy. And so you don't go into the king's presence all sad. Verse 3, and in every province wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. And so Esther inquires, finds out what's going on, and then she realizes the plot has been set. So look down in verse 12. There's communication between Esther and Mordecai through intermediary eunuchs. Verse 12, and they told Mordecai what Esther had said, and Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than the other Jews." So Esther's given a little bit of pushback, but he's like, "You're not getting out of this. If they're coming after all the Jews, you will be found out and you will be put to death. Like, that's just how this is going to go down." Verse 14, "For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether or not you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this." Probably the most famous words in the book, right? This is, God has put you here. You're here for this very purpose. This is sort of like Esther's destiny. You are here to deal with this one situation. And it's kind of interesting, like you see this throughout the Bible. There are characters who, it's almost like God just used them for one big thing, and then that was it. That was all they were needed for. Like, God just raised them up for this one thing, this one time, to accomplish his goal, and then that's really it. Then Esther, verse 15, told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." That's also the famous reply. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. So this is sort of Esther kind of waking up and realizing she's got a role to play, right? You're not just the queen. You're not just there. You've got a bigger role to play in God's economy. And this is where it's really kind of cool. Like, she's like, okay, well, I'm willing to sacrifice. I'm willing to go and to put it all out on the line. And if I die, I die. That's it. Okay, so Esther is going to go to the king in 3 days. Chapter 5, verse 1. "On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight." Again, there's this constant, something happens that wins her favor. It's God's providence. "And held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand." So nobody could come before the king unless the king invited him. If you came before the king and he didn't raise his scepter, you're dead. They just kill you. You don't ever approach the king. Even the queen can't approach the king unless he raises the scepter. So she goes. It could be death right there. She has favor in his sight. He raises the scepter. "Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, 'What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you, even to the half of my kingdom.'" He loves her. "And Esther said, 'If it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared the king.' Then the king said, 'Bring Haman quickly so that we may do as Esther has asked.' So the king and Haman came to the feast that Esther had prepared. And as they were drinking wine after the feast," there's more alcohol, "the king said to Esther, 'What is your wish? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled.' Then Esther answered, 'My wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast, and I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said." Why does she put it off one more day? Nervous?
Wanting to
Yeah, a little more wine. Yeah, we don't know. It could be that she was nervous. Could be that she chickened out the first time. It could be some sort of custom, you know, where if you're going to make a request, you don't do that. What's that?
Could be wine.
Could be wine, yeah.
Maybe she's strategic. Yeah, maybe.
Her husband likes parties.
Yeah.
He likes to be made a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Adding suspense.
Yeah, we're not told, and it's not clear from the historical record why it would go in multiple phases, but it does.
It also seems like it would stop and like take him off guard, because on the first beast would be like, why? Kind of weird. Like,
why is it just the three of us?
And then the second one is like, oh, maybe she just likes me.
Yeah.
And I'm cool.
Yeah.
Well,
and Haman is fabulously wealthy, and he's the second in command, and so this role reversal, he just doesn't see coming at all. Verse 9, and Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart, but when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, and all the promotions with which the king had honored him. He loves himself, doesn't he? He just, look at me. I mean, he is King Nebuchadnezzar, like, reincarnate, if we believe in that sort of thing. And how he advanced above the officials and the servants of the king. Verse 12, then Haman said, even Queen Esther, let no one come to the king with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow I am also invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. He's just enraged with bitterness and envy. Verse 14, then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, so like 75 feet high. In the morning, tell the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. Then go joyfully to the king, with the king to the feast. And this idea pleased Haman, and the gallows were made. All right.
If he had not done a second one, all this wouldn't, I mean, Haman's
that's true.
Would have come to a head.
Right. Yeah.
There wouldn't have been gallows to hang him on.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Which ends up being sort of the ironical twisting in the end, yeah. Okay. So we got Haman's arrogance, and now we have... Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
When Ellis and I were meeting a couple weeks ago, but we were trying to figure out why Haman was just so riled up by Mordecai not bowing to him knowledge, and why Mordecai refused to do so to him specifically. Do we know why, or just kind of randomly?
Well, it's not said why... It's not said why Haman specifically is particularly vengeful against Mordecai, except just that he won't bow, which is a great dishonor, right? I mean, Mordecai's really... In ancient times, like, you just bowed to royalty. Like, that's just what you did, and he should have. I don't think it's made clear why Mordecai specifically refuses that honor to Haman, or why Haman, like, that specifically bothers him. Like he's got all these sons, he's got all this wealth, he's the second most in charge, and it's like one dude.
But wasn't he very visible at the gate?
Mm-hmm.
So he was very visible in not doing this.
Right.
That was very disrespectful.
Yeah.
One.
Yeah.
But two,
right. Yeah.
You know, he wants to be the guy on, you know, paraded through all the people. And
right.
You know, so that's that pride thing that I think that, you know, I mean, that irritates.
Yep. Yeah. I don't think we know that, but yeah, I agree. You know, pride does weird things to people. It just does. Like, irrational things where you will just live in your own world. Yeah.
The part you just read, he's telling his friends and family his accomplishments. They know all this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, they didn't need to be told.
He's so full of himself.
He's got to be insufferable.
He's
really.
He's boasting to his wife
right.
about his wealth and his children.
Yeah.
Who else could know it but her?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
No one.
Who else knows your faults?
Well, true. Let me recount to you my resume. Yeah, but what a weird thing to do. Yeah.
You're also wondering if it had to do with him being an angry guy.
So that's interesting. So who do we also know who's there? There's another person that's representative here. So he's probably not Persian. That's a good point. I forgot about that. So Haman is probably not Persian. He's an Agagite. And you remember that Agag was the king of the Amalekites, if you remember that. And he was the one who was supposed to be put to death by King Saul, and he wasn't. Who put Agag to death? Samuel put him to death. And that was part of a fulfillment of the Mosaic law that the Amalekites were to be utterly wiped out when they came into the land. And so what we see is that never actually happened. And so the Amalekites always attacked Israel because they never put them to death. This is just an interesting side story. Thank you for reminding me that. I didn't put that in my notes. So he's probably connected to Agag, the Agagites, the Amalekites, who by law were to be put to death. They always, these were fierce people. In fact, the reason that the Amalekites were to be put to death, if you remember, is when Israel was coming up out of Egypt, they would attack the back, and they would hit all the stragglers, all the old people, all the weak. So they were just vicious and mean. And so God wanted them all to be put to death. Well, this seems to be, probably is, the last remnant of those wicked Amalekites. So here we have not even a Persian. It's the age-old Amalekites who are attacking the people of God. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Outside of the promised land, this battle is going on, which is pretty crazy. Yeah, thank you for reminding me of that.
Mordecai and Saul too.
Maybe?
Yeah.
Does it say that? Is he a Benjaminite?
His great-grandfather is Kish.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So that, assuming it's the same. Yeah. It's interesting. We have ancient records, Persian records, that mention Mordecai, like historical. Now, is it this guy? We don't know, but it's during that same time period. So it's very likely. I mean, if Mordecai rose to the second in power, I mean, it does make sense that his name would be thrown around and be in historical records. So. Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Huh. There's a lot of layers there. Yeah, that's cool. That's a great observation. Yeah. Yeah, very good. Okay, so we've got the great reversal. Chapter 6, verse 1. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. The king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Who would the king delight to honor more than me?" I mean, this is his arrogance. Like, of course he's playing coy. Like, he wants to honor me, and so I'll tell him what to do. Like, this is going to be great. Verse 7, and Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. You get to be dressed up as the king. You get to ride around as the king on all the king's stuff, wearing all the king's clothes. This is what happens when the king wants to honor somebody. Verse 10, then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes, and he dressed Mordecai, and he led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, this is so great. Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. You're just like, yes, like this is what you get. So it's the role reversal. Verse 12, then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife, Zeresh, and his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife, Zeresh, said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish people, then you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. That's crazy. They're like, you're done, man. You're done. Yeah. Oh, he's a Jew? Not a chance. Let's see. Okay, so then there's the next night, verse 14. Actually, it's that day. While they were still yet talking, while this, like, he's about to die, while they're still yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. So the king and Haman went into the feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine, more wine, after the feast, the king again said to Esther, what is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you, and what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled. Then Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king. Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who has dared to do this? And Esther said, a foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The plot is unmasked. Verse 7, and the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the palace where they were drinking wine. It's just crazy how much wine there is. It just, wine is all over the place. Like, if you're just reading a chapter a day, you don't notice it. But when you read the whole thing, you're like, this guy was just a drunken mess all the time. It's crazy. Anyway, so they're drinking wine. Verse 8, and Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, will he even assault the queen in my presence in my own house? As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high. And the king said, hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king was abated. So it's the great reversal, right? Everything falls on Haman's head. He lays the trap, as the proverb says, and then he falls into the trap. It's just great. It's just a great story. It's a great unfolding of the plot. And it's funny, like, I've read this, I don't know how many, 20, 30 times. And it's just good every time. Like, it's just fun. It's just a great work of God in the lives of his people. So the Jews are saved. If you remember, the decree was that they could kill all the Jews on that day. Can't reverse the decree, but what they could do is make another decree that said the Jews could defend themselves. And that was the decree that went out. So the Jews defended themselves. And so it was all defensive. It was not offensive in any way. It was, if you get attacked, then you can attack back. And they attacked back. Then the epilogue of the story is really how Mordecai rises to power. If you look over at chapter 9, verses 20 through 22, we don't know that Mordecai is the author of the book of Esther, but it seems as though maybe the things that he wrote down were the basis for a lot of the story. So chapter 9, verse 20, and Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month Adar, and also the 15th day of the same year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies. And as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So Mordecai wrote all these things down, and now this day that was supposed to be their death day ends up being their day of celebration of deliverance because God was with them. And then I just want to look at chapter 10 really quick, just three verses that kind of ties out the whole thing. King Ahasuerus imposed tax on the land, so he's getting his money back, and on the coastlands of the sea, and all the acts of his power and might, and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus. Again, he's the second Joseph or the second Daniel, whatever you want to call him. And he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. So pretty amazing. I just, you know, this is like practical application. God can do anything with any king, any ruler, at any time, in any way. And I think also it's just interesting, God also uses very imperfect people, very normal, average people to do some amazing things. Mordecai would not have been elevated to the second in command if he hadn't just like, hey, by the way, there's a plot to kill the king. And that wasn't even recognized until a long time afterward. And it got chronicled. And it was just, and such a, you know, quote unquote random thing. Hey, I can't sleep, so come give me a bedtime story. And it just so happens they're reading the bedtime story of Mordecai. Like, God uses very interesting courses of events to do things and to save his people. I mean, we've got Mordecai and Esther who eventually are used. Again, just normal people, you know, some sort of weird situation where Mordecai's taking care of Esther, some sort of tragedy in the family, and now here they are saving all their people. So it's just kind of a rags-to-riches story and just a wonderful work of God in the life of his people. Any last questions or thoughts or comments before we close? Good stuff. Very good stuff. All right, let's pray. Father, we are so thankful for our brothers and sisters of long ago, Mordecai and Esther, and just how you used them and how they were really just, they were kind of nobodies in the kingdom until this event of with Vashti came about, and you used them in great ways. And you delivered your people, and you still deliver your people. You're good to your people, and you use normal people for extraordinary purposes. And so, Lord, we just pray that we would be faithful, whether you've called us to some high-ranking thing or some small corner of your kingdom, Lord, that no matter what, we would be faithful, and we would trust you. We know that you can turn the hearts of kings just like a hose. And so, Lord, we pray that you would. We pray that it would be turned our kings, our representatives would be turned for righteousness' sake, and that we would honor you in every way. We know you can do it. You can do it in an instant. You can do it through means, and so we pray that you would do it well for your glory. Amen.